It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. There is no doubt we live in a highly politicized, highly polarized time. As we enter the midterm elections, there are a number of Republican candidates who are running with a promise of trying to impeach President Obama in the last 2 years of his term. A variety of challenges, both foreign and domestic, have President Obama's popularity at a low point, even among people who have historically supported him. It's a far cry from the mandate that the president and his political allies cited after his reelection 2 years ago. But what would constitute a mandate anyway? And how have presidents used the idea of a mandate to justify policy? Julia Azari tackles those questions in a new book called Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. Azari, who is assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, joins us in the studio now to talk more about mandates. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the nature of mandates in general here. The mandates are not a recent concept, but what is more recent is how its use has kind of evolved in more recent years.
Correct. I first got interested in the subject of mandates when I was a graduate student, and the question came up kind of in the, you know, in the shadow of the 2004 election. The question came up about what constitutes a large enough victory to be a mandate, right? Are some victories special? And if so, you know, what's the threshold? So if some elections really confer some unique and special authority on the president or on any elected official for that matter, is the cutoff 50%? Is it a majority? Is it 55%? You know, how do we determine that?
Well, and let me ask you a potentially dumb question. I mean, I think this is what you're getting at. Is there any way to separate a mandate from mandate rhetoric, mm-hmm. or is a mandate really something that only exists in rhetorical terms?
I think it's something that only exists in rhetorical terms. I will hedge about a lot of things, but I will say that unequivocally. I think that it is very difficult to take millions of votes and come up with some kind of meaningful picture out of that. The meaningful picture comes out of how we come to understand that, of the narrative that's spun out of that. And presidents are uniquely positioned to build that narrative. They obviously have a national stage. Rhetoric is a big part of what they do. But also presidents are uniquely positioned to need that narrative to justify what they're doing. And that's what I found. So stuck in this kind of intractable web of, well, how much is a mandate? What could possibly be a mandate? You know, you get in this kind of thing. And so theorists and political scientists say there's no such thing as a mandate. But every 4 years, and increasingly now, I think every 2 years after midterms, after gubernatorial races, everybody rushes to the question of, well, what did it mean? And is it a mandate? And so you have this kind of disconnection there between this concept that's really resonant. And if we're not voting for the government to do something in particular, then what are we doing? And yet these kinds of more thorny questions at the root. So I kind of said, you know, why mess with this question when we can just look at how do presidents use this? And that's where I found a story that was a lot different than what I think a lot of people would expect.
Right. I think as you turn back the clock and look at the early half, or really the first two-thirds of the 20th century, the concept of a mandate as it was used by presidents was a great deal different than we think of it today.
It was. So on the one hand, this book really focuses on the change that occurred in the late 20th century, where I find a real uptick in mandate rhetoric and in the importance of the mandate in presidential governance and the way that presidents not only talk about the mandate in national speeches to the electorate, but also to other people who are in government, to members of Congress, when they're addressing members of their own executive branch, also when they're out in the world and they're addressing and they're making a kind of local address to a smaller audience. I find that mandate rhetoric really kind of comes to the fore in a way that it didn't during the years of FDR, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson. But at the same time, I also find there's a kind of recurring pattern in the presidency, which is that presidents are constantly pushing at the boundaries of their authority. They're constantly doing things that are challenged by their opponents as really being outside of what the presidency should do or what presidents should do. And this goes back to Andrew Jackson, and his contest with Congress over the Bank of the United States, and he used the mandate to justify his strong actions then. And then I find this pattern recurs through the 20th century. Franklin Roosevelt talked very little about the mandate after the 1932 election. He talked a lot about the crisis and about solving the crisis of the Depression. But when things started to get a little bit more challenging for him after his second election, he was inaugurated again in 1937. At that point, the Supreme Court had invalidated a number of the important New Deal statutes. And Roosevelt was starting to fight back by threatening to change the structure of the Supreme Court. So he goes to Congress and has this proposal to reorganize the judiciary, to expand the court for every member over 70. And that's really received badly as a kind of dictatorial overreach. And that's when FDR starts trotting out mandate rhetoric. But it's not just – so the story about FDR I think is pretty interesting on its own. But then we see this occur over and over again. This happens with Richard Nixon, a kind of famous overstepper, where he refers to the mandate and to the election of – both the elections of 1968, which was a very narrow victory, and then 72, which was a broad victory, in the context of fights with Congress over the budget, fights with Congress and with, you know, with any number of opponents over Watergate. He used the idea of the 1972 mandate to defend himself against those charges. And what I argue is that in the wake of the Vietnam War – and Watergate and this kind of new public understanding of the danger of strong executive power, presidents are now kind of always dealing with this boundary situation and are in a much more defensive posture all the time than they were in the middle of the 20th century when public trust in the government and in the presidency was much higher, where the parties were much less polarized. And so to deal with this much more challenging and defensive environment, presidents have turn to mandate rhetoric, and that turn is really unrelated to election victory magnitude.
You point to Dwight Eisenhower as perhaps emblematic of presidents who sought to have broad appeal mm-hmm. without necessarily invoking this idea of a mandate. Here's a guy who was elected fairly easily, but he did not necessarily invoke the idea that he had a mandate in trying to bring broad appeal to his policies.
Right. Eisenhower was pretty reserved about claiming mandates. He talked a bit about his campaign in 1953. After the 1956 election, he really didn't talk very much about mandates at all. And one time a reporter asked him and he told the reporter that, you know, he was embarrassing him. And, you know, a very Eisenhower-like deflection. And so there's some degree, as I was looking at these different presidents, there's some degree you see their personal styles come through. But even beyond the personal styles, there are also these patterns where presidents who are near each other in time, even when they're different in every other conceivable way, have some similar mandate claiming habits.
Is this like Bush and Obama mm-hmm. as well?
Yeah, Bush and Obama, Carter and Nixon, and Eisenhower and LBJ. Those I look at those pairs in the book. With Bush and Obama, they're my two biggest mandate claimers after the elections of 2004 and 2008. Those are really – these are obviously two really different individuals. In some ways, the elections have some commonalities because they're both kind of easily spun as party victories. But both presidents really make a lot of that. Whereas, you know, in contrast, in 1953 when Eisenhower was taking office for the first time, we had a kind of similar – situation where the Republicans did really well. And Eisenhower really was much more reserved about making that case that the electorate had rejected Democratic policies, which was a big theme that Obama sounded a lot in 2009. He didn't talk so much about specific things he promised on the campaign trail. A lot of his references occurred in the context of either they were very broad, very general, or they occurred in the context of news interviews. One thing I'd like to say just about kind of the way, you know, putting the book together that was fun was that after I created this larger data set of mandate rhetoric, I went to six presidential libraries. So I've got all of these kind of stories from the speechwriters and White House staffers and communications leaders within the different different presidential administrations. And so the book really tries to go into and get a feel for, after the election had occurred and after the president took office, what did they really – you know, what were people saying about the election, and what were they saying about the political challenges that they faced? Not just what do we remember now that everything's been nicely tied up by history, but what were they saying at the time? And especially for some of these older ones, looking back at the Johnson administration and at the Eisenhower administration, the way that their employees and their White House their White Houses were looking at problems is a lot different than how we remember them in some instances.
Do you think – is there a danger to governing in mandate rhetoric? Does it paint a president into a corner, if you will?
I think that it does. I think that the normative implications that kind of how the world should be of this book are a little bit disturbing. First of all, the kind of governing from a place of defensiveness all the time isn't great. When we complain about presidents not having leadership or vision, this is kind of, I think, at the heart of that problem. There is a degree of painting into the corner, and I've been thinking a lot about this as Obama has been trying to deal with various situations in the Middle East. He campaigned with a specific idea about how he was going to conduct policy, and then events intervene. Undoubtedly, he learned new security information after taking office. Sometimes the mandate is kind of at odds with being pragmatic, which, you know, there's a real contrast there if we look at FDR, who was all about experiments and solving problems, and his rhetoric was very much about that. Contemporary presidents, not so much. The other problem is that it kind of passes the buck to the electorate. You know, Truman said the buck stops here, but when presidents justify their decisions in terms of what they promised they would do and what they were elected to do, it kind of puts the decision in the hands of the voters in a way that it sounds democratic. But, you know, there's a way of thinking about democracy that's kind of about, you know, we elect leaders and we want leaders to exercise good judgment and to lead. And I feel like that has kind of fallen out, at least, of presidential discourse over the last 30 years or so.
Well, and at the heart of this, when you go to the polling place and you flip a lever or you push a button or otherwise check a box, you're electing a person. It's not a laundry list of issues that you're necessarily signing off on.
Right. One thing that's interesting about that is that the development of mandate rhetoric has really kind of been about this parliamentarization of presidential politics. So, you know, in some countries, that is what you do. You vote for a party, and sometimes you can't even see the candidates on the list, right? You just vote for the party. And American politics has traditionally been really resistant to that. But there's no question that our party system has become more issue-oriented, more polarized, and that presidents have become much more dependent on their parties for support. Obviously, opposition's become a lot more organized. The gap between the president's, you know, party supporters and those in the opposite party in terms of approval is huge, and it wasn't always. So there's a lot going on there in terms of this becoming more like that system, and yet that's not the system we have in place, and the presidency is really not designed to operate that way.
At the heart of all this, there is an inherent irony that the times when a mandate might truly exist, in which the president is popular and has the greatest support, are the times in which the idea of a mandate is invoked the least, and vice versa. So if you say you have a mandate, you probably don't?
That seems to kind of, I mean, this gets again at the question of do you ever really have a mandate? But I think it's safe to say that if you say you have a mandate, the chances are you're saying it because you feel threatened in some way. And presidents say this when they're the least popular. Sometimes presidents are popular and their policies aren't, or vice versa, which speaks again to the difficulty of really ever determining what a mandate is. But I think that it's right to say that when we hear presidents talking about doing what they were elected to do, based on the research I've done, there was probably a conversation about that was about problems with public support. It was about the way – how well – opposition was organized, or somehow about, you know, feeling like something wasn't going well. It tends to be defensive rhetoric. And although the patterns in how presidents have talked about mandates have changed, to some extent that is constant.
Where does Congress fall in this equation? I mean, clearly individual congressmen and senators can't claim a national mandate, but the parties seem to employ mandate rhetoric when pushing their own policy agenda.
I think that's right. One of the things that I note in the beginning and end of the book is that I think this is starting to kind of leak out of just the presidential arena. There are reasons why this was kind of a presidential concept at first. Part of that has to do with the national idea. When Andrew Jackson trotted this concept out. In the 1830s, it was all about the president being the only person who was elected nationally. But now, as the parties have become more nationalized and as congressional elections and even, I think, gubernatorial elections have become more nationalized, I think I read somewhere that only 30% of Scott Walker's campaign money comes from within the state. And that's undoubtedly true in some other high-profile governor's races this year as well. I think that this concept is becoming more resonant for members of Congress and also in state-level politics. I think that the age of mandate politics has only just begun.
Julia Azari, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julia Azari's new book is called Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate, published by Cornell University Press. Azari, who teaches political science at Marquette, will talk about the book September 2nd at Boswell Book Company.